Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Augusto Macellari, and Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
On the show today, we'll be speaking to photographer Todd McLellan, whose images look to understand our everyday objects by taking them apart.
We'll also be hearing from musician and broadcaster Yolanda Brown. The MOBO-winning saxophonist will be discussing her new prize for young creatives and how she's hoping to inspire young people through music.
And we'll be joined by writer Keith Gasson, the Russian-American author and journalist, will be discussing his latest book at the end of the show.
That's all to come, plus a tune or two, and Monocle's own Bill Luti will be looking ahead to next week's news too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Hi, Og, how are you?
Very well. Happy to be back in the studio with you on a Sunday afternoon.
Very happy, and it's springtime as well, you know. Can you feel the change in the air?
I really can.
I can as well, actually.
And my birthday's in 1 week today.
I'll make a note of that. And the new issue is out as well, springtime.
Great.
Monocle new look.
So essential reading.
So a busy week for both of us.
Very busy. Shall we welcome Bill Luti to the studio to hear about what's coming up?
I'm very curious.
Which way?
Bill, welcome. We're very curious to know which stories have you chosen for us today.
Well, it's kind of a busy week. Today, elections in Thailand. Fernando, I know you love an election, don't you?
I love an election. And I'm very curious. I mean, the Thai election is always so interesting, so many factors. Do we have a favourite?
It's been a long time coming. It's been 8 years since their last election. So they're kind of thirsty to vote. There are so many people running. Basically, anyone can run. One of the princesses, she tried to get involved. The king said, no, this isn't for you. But there are 68 people running for prime minister. So I can't even imagine what the ballot paper is going to look like.
A3, probably.
It's like a scroll you have to like go through. You're not going to be surprised if your name's on there and people don't even notice. What's interesting about this is obviously it's been 8 years since their last. There are so many first-time voters. Anyone who's 26 or younger is going to be their first time. So apparently that's a potential 7.3 million new people coming to vote. The current Prime Minister, who is also the head of the military, is one of the favourites.
Funny that.
Yeah, because obviously he's in charge of all of the television and he's making speeches on the TV every Friday, half an hour speech, kind of telling all the good things he's done. But as mentioned, all these young people are kind of sick and tired of the old establishment, well, what has become the old establishment now for the last 8 years. So, yeah, fingers crossed that they kind of come out and vote and a new era of democracy for Thailand, perhaps.
Wasn't the last era of democracy ended in a coup d'etat by the military?
Yeah, there was a coup, and that's how this current prime minister got in. And he's kind of promised since then that he would have elections as soon as possible, he said. And now, finally, he's kind of decided that now is the time. So, yeah, exciting news coming out of Thailand this week.
Well, I'm sure we'll be covering here on Monocle 24, our daily shows. What about, what's the second story, Bill?
Tomorrow, well, and on Tuesday, Benjamin Netanyahu is in the US meeting Donald Trump. They've become kind of good friends, haven't they?
They're very close, and Netanyahu is very close to Bolsonaro as well in Brazil. I mean, all the good people.
That was last week, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Trump and Bolsonaro, Trump and Netanyahu.
I mean, and there's an election coming in Israel as well. Do you think this might play a part in that?
Exactly. So it's kind of seen as a bit of a bad move by Trump to see him, or, you know, trying to bolster his support in Israel. Israel kind of, when they see the US on their side, Israelis, they see this as a very good thing. So if they can see Netanyahu as having Trump's support, then perhaps that could help him. Interestingly, in 2015, before the last election, Netanyahu was in the US and he was like, hey, Obama, can I come and hang out? And Obama said, no, it's way too close to the election. And I didn't realise this is part of their policy. So if it's too close, maybe 2-3 weeks before an election, it used to be policy that he didn't meet with you. So even David Cameron, he got turned down a meeting with Obama for very similar reasons. But yeah, this is kind of seen as Trump
shaking things up again.
Shaking things up, stoking the Netanyahu fire.
Nice. Why not? Where next?
Well, a bit lighter, because it's been a bit election politics serious stuff. On Saturday, the new inductees of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame 2019 come in.
Who is in?
Well, I don't know how you feel about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
depends on who's... I mean, because I think they nominated various different people, right? Like from Madonna to Cher or something like that.
Yeah, it's loads of different people. It's kind of a random list. I'll read it. Radiohead, Janet Jackson, Stevie Nicks, for the second time. She's the only woman ever to be in twice. Def Leppard, The Cure, Roxy Music and The Zombies.
That is very eclectic. What are the metrics for entry? I mean, how can you be made famous twice?
Well, Stevie Nicks is in for herself and she's in for Fleetwood Mac.
Of course.
So there are a number of people who are in twice. There's some controversy about how it's decided. Basically, it's just kind of like some blokes sit around and decide and they like to keep it secret. They do accept suggestions, but yeah, they basically just decide themselves. What's interesting is the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame itself is in Cleveland, but they have the awards in New York because nobody wants to go to Cleveland.
Just
have it in New York, which is better. And I've been looking it up. Some members, apparently, of Radiohead will be attending, but probably not the good ones.
No Tom York.
No, Johnny Greenwood. Johnny Greenwood said that the idea of bringing more attention onto the band makes him feel very uncomfortable. Tom York is rehearsing for a piano concert with the Paris Philharmonic, so he's busy.
They're just sending the session guys along.
Yeah, they are. Interesting, though, David Byrne is introducing Radiohead. Trent Reznor is introducing The Cure. Brian May is going to be there. So, you know, it's a pretty big deal.
Will Janet be there? Going to be there?
I think, yeah, Janet's going to be there. Hmm.
Janet who?
Janet Jackson.
Oh, right.
Together again. All for you.
And just finally before I go, this time next week, might be in the EU, we might not be in the EU.
I'll be 29.
You'll be 29 on the 29th.
No, on the 31st, actually, this time next week.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, maybe all flights will have been grounded. We probably won't be able to eat any food. Who knows what's going to happen?
Yeah. Just cheery stuff. Well, thanks for that, Bill. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. Stay with us because we'll be talking about some photography next. Toronto-based photographer Todd McLellan is interested in how things work, and that means breaking them into bits before hopefully being able to put them back together again.
His images of everyday objects in pieces, ranging from smartphones to Amazon Echo speakers, make up his new book, Things Come Apart 2.0, and he joins us on the line now from Canada to talk about it. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, Todd. I mean, of course, we're very curious. I mean, where did you came up with this idea? When was the first time you started photographing objects this way?
I had first started in 2009. I started collecting objects that I had found on the street or in secondhand shops or people had discarded because they no longer wanted them. And that had sort of built up in my office, and I wanted to document them in some way to sort of give them new life. And I've always been interested in how things work and wanted to show them in a way that sort of represented that. So the first idea was to show them as an assembly diagram. So, you know, components all broken on linear with like lines to them, that sort of thing. And I did do that. So I gathered all these glass plates and the old phone was the first one that I did. And I laid out these things on the glass plates and it became way too much digital work to present it this way. Just, it didn't feel right for the project. Sort of frustration, I just laid it out on the ground and was pleased with what had come up. So if you see it, the phone laid out is very much different than near the end of the book where I started like concentrating on creating like rectangular shapes and keeping very close to how it was taken apart.
It's interesting to sort of hear you talk about the form that these disassembled objects take when you photograph them. Some of them remind me a bit of Cornelia Parker exploding a shed, that kind of thing. How do you go about capturing an object when it's been fragmented, when it's been atomized like that?
Behind that, there was basically, I always say I'm Gemini, so I have two sides to me. One is very structured and one is very free and open. I wanted to use high-speed strobe and throw them through the air and capture the pieces coming apart. Now, again, working with the phone, it was the first one. I was able to capture that in one shot. It's not the ultimate image that I use for the book. But as I got more complicated with the objects, I had to just throw them in sections. So they are still falling. So I had an assistant up on a ladder. He would drop them down on the focal plane, and I would catch them as they go through. So freezing them in time. So I'd take a couple different layers. So I'd say the foreground, the background, and the mid-plane. That would become photoshopped into one composition.
Todd, I would like to ask you, so, I mean, to do this type of work, you must be an incredibly meticulous person as well, right? Is that the case, or...?
I can concentrate on some things if I get into it and really set my mind to it. But I'm very... I have a lack of patience for the most part. So it's kind of a great healing process as well in terms of doing this and, you know, settling your mind. I do a lot of commercial imagery. So this is sort of like the complete opposite. Everyone needs like a personal project, and this is one of those, which is far different from creating advertisements that aren't necessarily the most real.
Let's talk a bit about your relationship with these objects that you're taking apart, because one of the things that you've been picked up as saying with Things Come Apart 2.0 is looking at our relationship to consumer goods, iPhones and MacBooks and these bits of technology that seem so intricate and ornate and almost magical, has been one way of phrasing it, touch screens, things like that, that people feel... where in the past, you know, maybe there was a mechanical process at play that could be deciphered and understood, people today feel a bit divorced from their objects. There's this kind of culture of when a phone breaks, throwing it out. And one of the lessons, I suppose, in your photo series is that actually they're not perhaps as intricate as they might seem. What's your relationship like with this kind of community of fixers?
I sort of discovered this, as well as some of the artists that were, like you're saying, Cornelia Parker. I sort of discovered this after I did it and put it out there, that the community of fixers, like iFixit, who Kyle Wiens did in the book, it's a growing community. So at the time, there was a few people doing it, but now it's actually grown quite substantially, which is great to see. And I think, like anything, if you're more educated in what you're doing, or what you have in front of you, it's not as hard as it looks. And I think people are starting to venture out and doing this sort of thing themselves.
Todd, I would like to ask, of course, in your new book, you concentrate more on the more modern gadgets. But I know you also, you know, in your previous book, it was the opposite. It was the older gadgets. What has been the, you know, the main difference with them? Of course, I think with the older ones, there was many more pieces, in a way, in certain products, correct?
Somewhat. I think some of the mechanical, depending on the mechanical objects, were simpler in terms of the amount of pieces. Now, the component counts are basically what I disassembled. So when you look at a circuit board from an older object, you know, you had a few transistors and resistors. But if you look at a circuit board on some of the smaller tech or the newer tech, I mean, you got thousands of components that I did not touch. They're still on the circuitry. In that sense, there's a greater amount. But if you look at, I always go to the SLR camera. So if you look at the digital camera and the film camera, there's two different ones. And the component counts is quite similar. Again, looking at the working pieces within them. But there's definitely a greater amount once you get into more complex, like smartphones and tablets and computers and that sort of thing.
Taking as an example the Amazon Echo, which was spoken about in an article elsewhere, it's only got 50 pieces, which might come as a surprise. But as you say, you know, when you get down to it, in a lawnmower or in a hairdryer, whatever it might be, perhaps there are many more pieces, but each one has a function that can kind of be processed through common sense. Whereas, like, when you get really into it with these technologies, you get down to circuit boards that can only kind of be made through industrial processes. And I sort of wonder what that means for people who are engaging with these objects as intimately as you are.
I mean, at that point, you can take it and hook it to a computer and go further with it. But really, you're just, as an average consumer, if you're looking to replace that, you're replacing that whole component, not pieces within that. So like smartphones, you can replace the screen, you can replace the motherboard, but you can't go right in there and take pieces of each and replace them. Like when I do take apart, like the tablet, say, I take the screen apart. So within the screen, there's like several different layers to create that screen. But once you open that up, it's destroyed, unless you're in a dust-free environment, like you said, an industrial process. There's no way of working it. So you replace that whole component.
So go back to your compositions. They look very kind of meditative, and you did touch on that just now when you spoke about how it allows you to kind of focus on something. When you're arranging them, are you looking for patterns? Are you consciously avoiding patterns? How do you go about setting up an image?
Taking them apart is very much the process for me. I've done a few where someone had taken them apart for me, but then I don't really have that connection of how they were put together, or, you know, when you're taking it apart, you understand how the object came apart. So I try to follow true with how the object is. And I generally start with the case near the center and then work towards the outsides of the composition, just so that it looks, and I organize as I take it apart, I organize the pieces in areas so that when I'm doing the layouts, I'm able to put it in the layout like it came apart, so that it's very methodical in that sense.
This is kind of like a mechanics approach. I remember I was a member of the kind of cadet force when I was at school, and I remember being shown how to strip a rifle. And there's this process by which you know, it's the same as stripping an engine. You lay everything out in the sequence that it's going to be put back together. Is that something that you kind of wanted to echo?
Yeah, I guess subconsciously that's something what I wanted to echo. Again, once I started this project, the Library of Congress sent me an image of a flute that was taken apart in the 1800s. He would build these flutes, put them together, and then take them apart, and he'd document the pieces of it in basically the same sort of way. But it was pretty amazing to see. People who work on motorbikes do the same thing because they're always replacing engines and changing things.
Todd, I would like to ask you, what was the most surprising teardown?
I think I change this answer every time I answer it. But the typewriter comes to mind. Just all the arms in it. You know, you push this button, it would push a lever this way and that way, and then eventually, finally, the type head slams down on the paper. Just the amount of arms and pieces that came out of that in order to get a simple letter type.
What have you been the most satisfying? Is there anything that you've really enjoyed that's given you a new perspective on the object and which you've then kind of enjoyed putting back together as well?
I think the modern technology. When I first started the project, it was all about the mechanics, but I felt you really need to explore further and you can't just stop there. And so then I started venturing into, you know, the screens and thought, okay, well, this is going to be the same every time. And it is quite similar, but I find that the most satisfying. And I've repaired my phone myself, a few different phones. And again, I put back the Amazon Echo and got it working. I've got a great video of it all taken apart, but I connected just some of the components with wires and so that it still works, but it looks like it's completely apart. But I think I am appreciative of the modern technology and how there is, for the most part, if it's a quality object or a quality technology, it can be put back together and made to work again.
Thank you so much, Todd. Todd's new book, Things Come Apart 2.0, is out now. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Time now for a tune. In a moment, we'll be hearing from saxophonist Yolanda Brown. So this is from her most recent album, Love, Politics, War. With vocals from Phoebe Edwards, this is No More War.
That was Yolanda Brown featuring Phoebe Edwards with No More War.
Musician Yolanda Brown's skill and creativity on the saxophone has earned her two MOBO Awards and allowed her fusion of genres such as jazz and reggae to reach ever larger audiences. She'll be playing to London's cavernous Alexandra Palace later this year.
She's also a broadcaster, appearing across UK TV and radio, most recently with Yolanda's Band Jan, a show on the BBC's CBeebies channel that aims to get kids excited about music.
Not only that, but she's just launched a new initiative, the Drake Yolanda Award, aimed at encouraging creativity for 16 to 30-year-olds. Earlier, Monocle's Tom Hall spoke to Yolanda to learn more.
Yeah, so the Drake Yolanda Award I set up alongside James Drake, who's an amazing entrepreneur in science publications, and he's great philanthropist too. So he's very passionate about sports science and concussion research and as well music, which is where sort of our journey together began. I wanted to set up a fund for emerging artists. I remember what it's like to sort of get into this industry, and I'm sure you'll learn later on it was a very unorthodox journey for me. And actually, when you decide to do that transition, a little bit of financial help goes a long way, you know, whether it be for recording, for touring, for PR, and all those things, all those ingredients are really important to sort of really make a noise in the industry. So we've set up this award, and it's a pot of £30,000 for 10 artists. They'll get £3,000 each. And for me, it was important that the application process was a bit different too, you know. We're creatives. And so, you know, doing a cash flow forecast and a budget isn't always the best way for creatives to get their point across. So we have a shortlist process. The applications will be whittled down to 20, and they'll come and speak in front of an industry panel from journalists to promoters and artists as well, and speak about the project. It's amazing when you see an artist light up when they're speaking about their creative process and what they want to get across. And we just want to hear from artists, people that really want to communicate with an audience, have a brand that says something. And any way that I can help, and this award goes a long way in doing that, yeah, is my passion.
And so, I mean, this is about opening up doors for other musicians. And you mentioned it briefly. You must have been playing saxophone all your life, I imagine, but you maybe about 10, 12 years ago, you weren't quite sort of in the full artistic world there. What were you doing before that? And when was that eureka moment where you said, oh no, I should be a musician full time and I should pursue it properly like that?
Yeah, so 10 years ago, I was studying a PhD in management science. I was going to be a management consultant. That was the aim and the dream. And I picked up the saxophone age 13. And I remember, you know, picking up the saxophone, I'd played different instruments before that. But there was something about sort of using my breath to create the sound, the vibration of the instrument. I played the tenor saxophone to start, so it's got that really meaty sound. And it was a Christmas holiday before I was going to start my lessons. And I just enjoyed playing along with my dad's records, sort of making up my own songs, which was improvisation. I didn't know that at the time. And I guess I was a bit of a rebel then, because when I started lessons, it was quite a very traditional system I was going into, which was about the grades and theory. And so after a year, I kind of left that form of teaching and went it alone. So I'm self-taught as a musician, and it was always a hobby. It was for me. It was me playing my emotions in my room, and I was always going on to study business, maths and Spanish.
I'm intrigued about that sort of that kind of, I don't know what you call it, a juxtaposition, though, because, yeah. I don't know, management courses, it does not sound like the same world that a renowned musician would be trying to get involved in. Was it something that you felt out of place in, or do you really enjoy both those sort of analytical processes and being creative?
I tell you, I loved it. I honestly loved it. And for me, music was a personal thing. I never imagined music being performance, even at that point. You know, I'd had opportunities to perform, but that was never it for me. I loved just creating music, and it was a personal, almost like writing in my diary, if you like. So I was so passionate about my research, and my PhD research was about combining the soft side of solving problems, business problems, and the hard side, which is the maths and, you know, what the computer says or what the algorithm says. And so I guess in my everyday life, I've done that. It's kind of combining that traditional system with a softer side that is, you know, how do you feel? What is it saying? And I still do it all the time today. So I guess it was quite natural. But then I joined a band as a humble student during a summer to play in the horn section. The band fell away. I was left there. The manager said, you know, I could manage you as a solo artist. And my response was, well, I'm a humble student, so anything to add some money would be great. Before I knew it, I was sort of writing my own music and performing more. During that time, the Mobos came, which was amazing. I guess when you say a eureka moment, that would be it for me, because it's, wow, there's people listening.
you've won a couple of Mobos, right?
That's right, yes. Yeah. So I won 2 Mobos for Best Jazz. And at that time, I was, well, sort of finding my own voice and finding my own music. And they came very early, I think, in that career. But if anything, it was the sign to say, something's here. You know, you might want to react to this. And that's what happened. I was spending more time after the Mobos. I was asked to come and play for the Russian president and, you know, travel the world. And I was spending more time away from university than I was. and so I made the decision to put my PhD on the back burner. And 10 years on, I'm enjoying it. I still check the journals every so often to see if anyone's researching what I was researching. But I love my job.
I must ask, you mentioned it there. Did you get to meet Putin?
I didn't at the time. It was Medvedev.
Oh,
so
okay, this is this total mystery. I was suddenly like, wow, that's quite.
I know,
strange.
It would have been very current. I know, yeah. But no, it was a fantastic gig in the Winter Palace, and all so ornate and beautiful. It was really good.
Wow. Let's talk about the saxophone itself, yeah. Because I mean, as you've said, you're trying to encourage younger musicians to sort of get their brand across and stuff. It's quite strange, isn't it, the way we sort of perceive musicians that sing. Because they seem to just get all the limelight and, you know, they're the people that we put on headline bills and stuff. And then people who only play instruments and sing less,
yeah.
I don't want to say sidelined, but they're not as like high profile most of the time. And,
yeah.
And until you get to that really, really upper echelon of, you know, this is the absolute don of whatever instrument they're
yeah.
doing. I mean, was that something you were aware of coming up? Because your profile is building and building, but I guess it's... You're constantly judged on your merits rather than some sparkly kind of Hollywood-ized image of what you're doing, you know?
Yeah, I guess the thing I realised probably more recently, and I was kind of getting there when in my younger years, is that I can only be me. And I don't get that same buzz and zeal from just singing. You know, I do sing in my act sometimes, and even more now, and we'll get to it later with the CBeebies show, I sing for the children, you know? But actually, for me, I love playing the saxophone, and I love even more having an audience that are thinking, I don't think I'm going to get this. You know, they've walked into the theatre and thought, this is just saxophone. What is this going to be? And seeing them leave the theatre and think, that was a great experience. I'm hooked now. What else can I get? And it almost feels like, yeah, that's a great thing to have been able to do for somebody. And when you sort of close your mind to what you're used to, you realise that not having words opens up the music so much more. You know, you can interpret it how you want to. I can say what I want to with the music. And I guess from being a presenter, I do present a lot on stage. So I tell people what the song is about, what I'm feeling when I'm playing it, so they can identify with it. But it's a great thing not to have words sometimes. And I think the world's coming round bit by bit. Instrumental music is being used really well in adverts and films, and being respected and recognised even more. So yeah, to be up front and be the lead in a band and not have vocals is becoming less strange, and I'm glad to be a part of it.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned there your CBeebies series, Yolanda's Band Jam.
Yes.
How did you get into that? And what's the secret to getting kids to enjoy music? Or is there no secret? Are they easier to have them enjoy sort of what's going on?
I'm loving the reaction of the children to this show. You know, I'm getting messages online of, you know, parents filming their children dancing in the living room and just being so free. And actually, that's how we should enjoy music. I think as we get older, we learn about our inhibitions and, you know, how we should act. And I'm very much about that, even in my live shows as Yolanda Brown, the saxophonist. I tell the audience, if you want to dance, if you feel your body starting to move, don't fight it, you know, enjoy the music. And actually, you see people that haven't got up and danced in years and thinking, oh, yeah, this is great. This is what I should be feeling at a jazz show, you know. So in a similar way with the children's show, just being able to bring live music to them is kind of where it all began, really, because we hear music in children's television all the time, but to see the instruments, to hear from the artists, you know, it's a house band, Yolanda's Band Jam. So we have Yolanda's band, the Band Jaminals, and then we're joined by a special guest in each episode. So we've had Anushka Shankar on the sitar, Newton Faulkner on the guitar. We've had the didgeridoo and the birimbau and lots of different amazing instruments. And hearing, number one, how the artist identifies with their instrument is great for the children to see, but also to understand how those instruments are made, how they make the sound, seeing other young people enjoy music, how they make music. Yeah, it just kind of introduces a little bit more of music education, but in a fun way. And actually, when we hear music, we should want to dance or express ourselves, whatever the music is telling us to do. We can learn a lot from these children, I tell you. Be free, be free.
Yolanda's Band Jam.
Okay, Banjammers, this song is all about rhythm, and rhythm is the patterns of sound in the song. So I want you to listen for the elephant walk and stomp along with us. Make sure you're stomping at home too. Here we go. Let me see that stomping.
1, 2, 3, 4. Stomp, stomp, stompy, stomp.
Do you prefer playing music for the kids, or do you prefer trying to bring an audience of sort of arms folded, super serious adults on board? What's your preferred space?
You know, it's always been both. And it's interesting. I'm an independent artist and I always have been. But having sort of meetings with marketers or PR or even labels, interest from labels. And, you know, the question is always, who's your target audience? And I've always said from when I first started my career and having my own solo concerts that in my audience, you have people aged 5 to 8 up to 50 to 80. You know, everybody is there, and it sounds cliche. It sounds like I haven't done my market research, but everybody is there and they can all enjoy it. And so Yolanda's Band Jam, it's not sort of baby music. It's real live music for children. So it's for everyone. And honestly, I've been getting a lot of messages through social media to say, you know, I'm watching Band Jam, but I don't have kids. You know, so it just shows that music is for everybody. And so I don't change the way I am with the audiences. I just be me.
And you do have some big audiences coming up. You're playing at Alexandra Palace, which is a big old room, isn't it?
Oh, I'm so looking forward to it. I was based in North London up till recently, and so it's going to be amazing to go back and play there, yeah. I love playing the jazz clubs, you know, and the intimacy that we feel. But then actually playing the Royal Albert Hall, which is a 5,000 capacity, it still feels that intimate. You know, the audience is right there on you. The same with O2 Arena here in London, you know, playing there. I still feel the closeness to the audience. So it doesn't change anything to me, you know. And I guess most recently down the lens of a camera, you're still communicating with an audience and with a listener. So I love that sort of difference in the rooms, and I just love how the music affects the audiences in different ways.
Okay, so I did some research before this interview, a tiny bit. I obviously went on your website, and there was very, very helpfully, there's a long bio, which I did read.
And then
there's a quick fact section. And I was like, well, obviously, I'm going to look at these.
Good, that was just for you.
Well, actually, there's loads of them, and they're all really interesting. So it's not actually that quick. But I wanted to ask you about a couple of them. So
sure.
Yolanda is known to sometimes give a pair of heels away. Give a pair of heels away to audience members at her gigs. What's that about?
This is true. It first started at, where were we, the Barbican. I love to wear heels. I feel it helps my posture. I feel dressed up. And as you say, you know, playing the saxophone, you're behind the instrument all the time and you can't wear fancy lipstick and, you know, fancy costumes. So I love my heels, and I like to wear gold heels as well at times. And I'm always being asked about it. I don't know why. The ladies love it. And they're saying, how do you do the concert in those heels? And so I thought I'd share the love, you know.
In a
wonderful way, the lady that won them, she came to my next concert here in London at the Royal Festival Hall, and she wore the shoes 2 years later.
Another one. So you've toured with Billy Ocean, The Temptations, Errol Brown, Beverly Knight and Diana Krall. What have you learnt from doing music in some of those situations with legends like that?
From them, I've just learnt the work ethic. The Temptations, through all the time that they've been legends in our musical world, they work like 300 dates of the year and yet give 200% every single time, and how approachable they were. So if you think of the places they've played, the people they've met, and the same with Billy Ocean, their dressing rooms are open. If I'm walking down the corridor, oh, Yolanda, come in. How are you feeling? How are you doing? How did you find it last night? You know, and I just thought that was amazing, because sometimes you meet people and they think, yes, I've earned the right not to speak to you. But the fact that they were just so approachable, I thought, I want to be like that and I want to work as hard, you know.
And then this was my favourite. Yolanda also loves to race cars. You can find her driving at a racing track on her days off. Do you compete? Like, what's that?
This is now sort of a painful fact to me, because yes, I love racing. You know, in the very early days, I used to drive the tour bus. I have a band full of guys, but it used to be sort of me driving the tour bus. I remember pulling up we were in Scotland, and it was on tour with The Temptations, and they were like shaking their head at the guys, like, how are you letting her drive you? But I just love being, you know, in the machine. I did a show once for Ron Dennis. He was the head of McLaren at the time. And that was kind of my pathway into the racing world. And I thought, I'm not letting this go. I've always wanted to do this. I love the karts, but I always wanted to be a single-seater driver when I was growing up. And from there, I started working on my ARDS license, which is the racing driver's license. And I was getting really, really close, about to take the exam. And then the touring just took off. So as you say, it's great to be able to do so many things, but then the passions sometimes go to the wayside. So I haven't been on a track day for a little while, but whenever I'm off, I'm always racking up the hours. I love it.
If money was no object, what's your dream car? What would you be spending all your touring money on?
Oh, well, the thing is, I would love a racing car, really. You know, even if it's a Formula 3 car that I can have on the weekends, you know, just go to the track in the bottom of the garden. That would be a dream. But in terms of dream car, I love the SUVs. I love being high off the road as well, which is kind of opposite of racing. I think I would like, there's a new Jaguar SUV that I've had my own for a little while. So, yeah, anyone listening? Hello.
Yolanda Brown there speaking to Tom Hall. And you can find out more about the Drake Yolanda Award by heading to drakeyolanda.org. And Yolanda's upcoming tour dates are at yolandabrown.co.uk. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. We hear a lot about Russia and its position on the world stage in the news, but we don't hear too much experience of what it's like to live there, work there, grow old there, or maybe have a Russian-American grandson come and visit.
The latter idea informs the premise of author, journalist and editor Keith Gesson's recent novel A Terrible Country. The semi-autobiographical tale, with its title firmly tongue-in-cheek, sees main character Andrei travel to Russia to look after his ailing relative and is in equal parts bitingly funny, yet fond portrait of the country too.
Earlier, Monocle's Paige Reynolds spoke to Keith Gesson about the book, and she began by asking how his work as a translator for Russian writers and writing has helped influence his own.
The one thing that definitely played a part in this book, In a Terrible Country, is my work with Kirill Medvedev, who is kind of, you know, the basis for one of the characters in the book. So certainly kind of inhabiting his, you know, his writing and his mind in the process of translating him certainly made it easier to write that character. But in terms of with someone like Petrushevsky, who I think is just a genius, I almost don't even learn anything from translating her because I don't even understand how it's put together. I don't understand how it works. And I'm terrified to change anything or even to kind of make the sorts of adjustments that I think it's sometimes wise for a translator to make because I really don't understand how she does it. Yeah, so for me, translating is very kind of separate. And, you know, as much as I find writing fiction to be sometimes miserable, I you know, translation is even worse.
Yeah. Let's move on to the book and perhaps all the misery. It's got quite an apt title, A Terrible Country. First, let's talk about the title. I mean, I believe Baba Sieva, who's the grandmother in the book, tells Andrei, who's the main character, when he comes to visit her, why have you come back? It's a terrible country. And maybe you could tell us a little bit more about the name.
It's kind of funny because when I named it that, it was like 2014, 2015. So I thought it would be pretty clear to people what I meant by a terrible country. Obviously, Russia. In the intervening years, I found, you know, when the book came out last year, that I really had to explain that I meant Russia, not America or any number of other terrible countries that have emerged and manifested their terribleness in the last few years. But for me, it became a pretty good title because it does come from the grandmother, right? And the grandmother is this person who has lived her whole life in mostly the Soviet Union, right? And then the Soviet Union falls apart. And even though she has hated the Soviet Union and she's very happy that it fell apart, you know, it turns out that she loses her savings, she loses her dacha, her husband, you know, loses his job, right? And she kind of loses her sense of herself in the world, right? She doesn't really understand how she fits in. And the answer is she doesn't, right? I mean, this is the kind of story of a lot of elderly people in the post-Soviet period, not just elderly people, but definitely elderly people who were really just cast aside. There was no place for them in the new Russia. So that's the country where she spent her whole life, and that's what it did to her. And at the same time, she refuses to leave. She doesn't want to go anywhere else. So, you know, when she says that, it's complicated, right? It's a terrible country, but it's her terrible country. For me, that title is in quotation marks. I would not myself call Russia a terrible country. I haven't earned that right.
It seems a little tongue-in-cheek anyway. I'm quite interested in what you were just saying about Baba Sieva and the fact that I suppose a lot of the time when we hear stories about people that have lived through Soviet times and they're now in this sort of chaos of the post-Soviet world, they're often quite nostalgic for communism. And is it important to you that, you know, she's actually not nostalgic necessarily for the regime, but she still has this sort of sense of loss?
It's based on my actual grandmother, so that was kind of given to me, but I like that. I think, in fact, it's atypical, right? I think there's a lot of people, and this is kind of the voting base to this day of the Communist Party, right, is these elderly people who even are nostalgic for Stalin. She wasn't, right? She wasn't at all. And yet, her world was really turned upside down. So I find that to be a kind of more interesting case. I think it does help the novel kind of. You don't have to have loved a political system, right? Or even, for that matter, a country, to then feel kind of bereft and confused and kind of set adrift when it's gone.
So you sort of touched on it there. This is in many ways quite autobiographical. I guess I'm wondering how autobiographical it is. And, you know, you yourself went over to Moscow to look after your grandmother. And did you go over there with the mindset that you were going to write a book, or did it happen a lot more organically?
I definitely did not go over there to write a book. I mean, I went over there to mostly take care of my grandmother, but I also wanted to do some journalism while I was over there. In terms of the kind of my relations and living with my grandmother, it was very intense. It was very difficult. She was losing her hearing. She was losing her memory. I had all these activities planned for us, as I describe in the book. And then, you know, it turns out she just going out for her, going to the movies, you know, taking a trip to the park was not actually a lot of fun for her. So most of the time while I was over there, I was kind of just trying to figure out how I could be a decent kind of caretaker and friend for my grandmother. And it was only when I came back to New York that I thought, well, that was a very kind of intense experience that I would like to write down. So I started writing it down, and I had different kind of ideas about what I would do with it. And I mostly kind of wrote it down in a kind of memoiristic vein, more or less as it happened, thinking, oh, you know, it could be a memoir, it could be a novel. And then, you know, once I wrote it down, I saw that, well, that, like, what actually happened once you wrote it down did not actually capture the what it felt like while it was happening. And, you know, mainly the feeling that I had at the end, when I left, was that I was abandoning my grandmother. I'd been there a year, my visa was running out, all sorts of objective ways I had to leave. But it felt like I was, like, leaving her there to die. And I wanted to write the book in such a way that the reader would feel like that's what the narrator had done. And in order for the reader to feel the way that I had felt, I had to kind of fictionalize it. I had to make that dilemma a lot more stark. I had to make the abandonment at the end a lot more clear. That was a kind of big change from the kind of autobiographical material. Another big change was, you know, I started out writing, you know, I really admire a lot of the writers who are working right now. Sheila Hedy, Ben Lerner, I like these books where they're just like, my name is Sheila, I'm a writer, right? And but it's a novel, you know, and where they don't actually fictionalize their authorial persona. They just say, here, you know, here I am, right? And it would be a waste of time and a kind of cheap trick to change it. When I did that with myself, it kind of just felt flat. You know, initially the kind of narrator was like a journalist and a translator. And it was just boring to me. Once I turned him into an academic, kind of failed academic, it just became a lot more fun. I really enjoyed writing those sections. You know, once I did that, and I found, well, here's some other stuff that could happen to him that would be fun. I still want it to feel like a memoir, I think, and people kind of read it as memoir, and that's fine with me. You know, I know a lot of fiction writers would take umbrage and you know, that they were not being given credit for their wonderful imagination. I don't really have a wonderful imagination, but I do, you know, I feel like I have a low threshold for boredom. So when I've written
something, helps.
When I've written something, I start reading it and I get bored very easily. Mm. So I'm pretty good at cutting stuff out if it's boring. As a reader, I enjoy books where I feel like the writer has just kind of written a memoir and called it fiction. I enjoy that. So.
Yeah, I think that there's just so much humor, which I guess you don't perhaps expect from a book called A Terrible Country that's largely about Russia. I thought the academic sort of plotline was quite interesting, and you write in quite a tongue-in-cheek way about the academics who go to Russia to, I guess, mine these sort of stories of post-communist transition, sometimes sort of for personal gain. I thought it was quite funny. Andrei's academic advisor is so excited about his trip to Moscow to kind of excavate his grandmother's story, and he says that shit is gold. Do you think there is a tendency for people in that world to go to Russia and kind of over-dramatize maybe what's happening there?
Yeah. I mean, I think not just academics. I mean, academics, you know, I think journalists are the kind of worst offenders. We, and I do this too, we go in there and we spend a week or we spend a month, we spend a year, but still, you know, at the end we leave. Right. And then we come back to, you know, the US or the UK and we write it up and people say, oh, you were so brave. Periodically, you know, I'm not a very kind of anti-Putin journalist in my I don't like Putin, but I don't write a lot of stuff about how Putin is terrible. But even so, you know, people will periodically say to me, oh, you know, are you in danger? Right. You wrote this thing about how traffic in Moscow is bad and you know, are they going to get you? And I'm like, are you kidding me? No, they're not. You know, they're not going to come to New York. No, they do not care what I've written. Right. This is I am not in any danger. Right. Whereas there are Russian journalists who are, in fact, in a lot of danger. Right. So and I think a lot of us feel uncomfortable and kind of like we're fraudulent when we are part of that dynamic. At the same time, that's the job. Right. I mean, I don't think it's bad to go somewhere, talk to a bunch of people, and then write something for your home audience. I don't think that's an unethical activity, but it's definitely one that's fraught, and there's no way of kind of getting out of that trap. So I was trying to, you know, and ultimately Andre falls into it also, even as he thinks he's not. Yeah, it's something I think about a lot. It's something I think there's not really a solution to. But I think it's worth kind of thinking about it and talking about it.
What's it like to be a Russian American writing about Russia for an American audience?
I like it. I very much think of myself as an American, and in kind of that's the language that I write and think in. And yet I have this, but I'm also, you know, very interested in Russia. I grew up in a Russian household speaking Russian. Speak Russian to my kids. I find it fascinating every time I go over there. So I really enjoy kind of being a sort of translator, so to speak, of what things are like in Russia. I find myself often very frustrated by, you know, reading kind of Western depictions of Russia that I think are superficial or kind of biased. You know, I mean, part of the impulse for the book was this experience of being in New York and reading, you know, the New York Times and or not even, you know, even the Russian press about what's going on over there. And it's terrible and horrible. And then you show up and it doesn't feel that way at all. Right. And even as this terrible and horrible stuff is going on, the country has gotten a lot richer. Some people are living much better than they used to. And also just the kind of fact about even the most, not the most oppressive, but, you know, most oppressive political systems still let people basically go about their lives, right? I mean, if you don't turn on the TV, you can go weeks and months without encountering Vladimir Putin, you know, or really mostly without really encountering the state. So, you know, the actual day-to-day experience of living in a place like that is it doesn't feel like what you read about in the papers. And the other thing I think that we miss in the West is the fact that there's a lot of Russians who like Putin. And the reason they like him is that they had a really bad experience of the post-Soviet transition. The 1990s were really horrible for a lot of people in the late 80s. Putin is a kind of answer to that. And he's not the right answer, but he's an answer. And I think as long as we don't understand that, we're going to keep getting Russia wrong.
Keith Gessen speaking to Paige Reynolds there, and A Terrible Country by the author is out now. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly.
So that's it, Og. It's been a pleasure. Some good interviews in there. Quite enjoyed the Keith Gessen's chat that Paige did about Russia, which is for me has always been a very curious country that I want to find out more.
you never know what's going to happen next. You could say you're always guessing.
Got it. That's the most wonderful thing about the Brits. You guys know. What's the name of that?
Pun.
You guys love a good pun. Brazilians are quite bad at it.
Well, maybe it's the language that's conducive to it. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall and myself. Our studio manager was Cassie Galpin. The Monocle Weekly will be back again next week. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Augusto Macellari.
And from me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
Bye.
Bye, ciao.